You're listening to Nick Luck Daily. This edition is brought to you by FitzDares, by the Racehorse Owners Association, and by Thoroughbred Racing Commentaries Global Rankings. Good morning, welcome to the show. Thanks for listening. It's Tuesday, October the 19th. Now, rows about prize money and nothing new in UK horse racing, but please do not turn off as soon as I mention this, because this latest spat between the National Trainers Federation, the Professional Jockeys Association, and the Arena Racecourse Company, ARC, is a very interesting one. It's a multi-dimensional one, and it has consequences for the future of the sport as a whole. Lydia Hislop is with me today. Lydia, what's happening here, and why is this a little more interesting than normal?
Well, negotiations for the all-weather programme between ARC racecourses and the horsemen have broken down. ARC were, according to them and according to the horsemen, some members of the horsemen's group, offering more money in turn for 9 race cards that modelling would widely suggest would have an adverse effect on field sizes in that period, but a positive effect on levy income. And this essentially boils down to what should the future of racing be about? How should British racing be laid out? And the fact that there is no one true answer, it kind of depends on your perspective. The argument, to my mind, boils down to whether you're into the short term, look, more money, not sure how much or whether it's as much as it should be, but it's more money, or long-term, keep our fans engaged in the sport via exercising some form of quality control. And clearly, it's easier to make the more money argument than the arguing for more races, but less easy to argue for less racing, because it relies on things that are more difficult to define. And at this point, improbably, it seems that the long-term argument has won.
It does, for the time being. That long-term argument has been put forward by the National Trainers Federation, or that's the way they would like you to see their argument and the way it's framed. They have not agreed with their fellow members of the Horsemen's Group, the Racehorse Owners Association and the Thoroughbred Breeders Association, who were quite happy to take the deal that ARC racecourses were putting on the table. We're going to hear from the president of the Racehorse Owners Association and chairman of the Horsemen's Group, Charlie Parker, in a few moments, who takes a different view. But first of all, here's trainer Rafe Beckett, who's part of the NTF National Trainers Federation Council. And I put it to him, you've got £5 million on the table, Rafe, and you've blocked the deal that your owners wanted. Why?
Well, we didn't act as a block. We came very close to agreeing a deal on Saturday night. The NTF had moved significantly with the PGA, had moved significantly on the original offer. As the ROA said, they would have signed a deal long ago. This was a significantly better deal than first appeared. But Saturday night we agreed, and on Sunday morning the ARC went back on a significant part of what had been agreed on Saturday night. Both the PGA and the NTF felt that the deal wasn't that good anyway. It was opaque, a long way from being transparent or binding from ARC's point of view. And despite that, we got very close to an agreement.
But that's £5 million that the sport is now not going to have. And yet the people who pay your bills, the owners, said that they wanted it. How do you square that with your owners who said, well, our association voted to take this deal and you've decided that you don't like it for reasons that are rather unclear?
No, that's not true. Rupert was very clear in his statement after the deal broke down last night. ARC were proposing an increase in race volume during the winter or weather period in return for the additional prize money. Martin's been very clear that ARC are much happier with 10 races of 7 runners than they are with 7 races of 10 runners. He said that to me a number of times. And I don't believe that punters who pay for this sport are in agreement with that. I don't think anybody believes that. It suits ARC to have that deal. It doesn't suit the long-term prosperity of the sport, doesn't fit with the long-term prosperity of the sport. We're heading in a direction that greyhound racing went many years ago, and look what's happened to them.
Rafe, a lot of trainers who you've been closely aligned with, John Gosden being the most prominent one who springs to mind, when talking about levy reform, have said racing needs to show that it can help itself before it goes to government with a begging bowl, for want of a better phrase. And now government can just turn around and say, well, so much for self-help. You've just turned down 5 million quid.
Well, I would say that short fields, i.e. 3 and 4 runner races in February and March, which would have happened under this deal, under the BHA's own modelling, I would say that's self-harm, not self-help.
So, Rafe, what's going to happen now?
Well, first of all, this deal, once broken down, wasn't what Martin led us to believe in terms of prize money. You know, once it was spread out, 9 race cards, you know, it wasn't going to be what he would have had us believe it was going to be. That's the first thing I would say. Second thing I would say is Martin says this deal isn't dead. It's not dead in my opinion. We've still got till Thursday night to do a deal. So the BHA are happy, as my understanding, to have us continue talking, and we're open to carry on talking. But this deal has got to be transparent, binding, sustainable, and for the long term. That's the PJA and NTF's position, and neither body believes that was the case with the deal as it was written.
What do you want? What's the figure that you want or you think would be acceptable? So is it about having the same amount of races as there are and more money for those races rather than... You basically don't like the idea of added races on the cards.
No, I don't. That's not true, Nick. I don't like the idea of short fields. That's what I don't like, personally. And that's what the NTF and PJA don't want. Short fields don't suit the PJA, and they don't provide a compelling product. And punters want to bet on competitive racing, and the punter funds the sport.
But isn't your first responsibility to your owners?
We're not going to make the sport sustainable for the long term if we don't have compelling racing with an average field size of between 8 and 9 or close to 8. That provides a sustainable product for the long term. This isn't about the short term, but this deal was a short term deal that had long term consequences. That was our belief.
Rafe, what does this say about the effectiveness or otherwise of the Horsemen's Group?
The Horsemen's Group does a very good job, but the way the sport is structured means that the participants are up against corporations, and the participants all have their own businesses to deal with. We're training horses or riding horses or looking after horses, and that's our main occupation. In that sense, we are compromised when dealing with corporations like ARC or the Jockey Club.
Rafe Beckett there. Lydia, we'll hear from Charlie Parker in a few moments' time. Quite notable the way Rafe just ended that discussion.
Yes, it's interesting that it's ARC or Jockey Club racecourses, which, you know, wouldn't be the old-fashioned view of that, would it? It was suggesting that ARC and Jockey Club racecourses these days might have quite a similar approach.
We'll come to that in a moment. I should remind listeners that Nevin Truesdale, Chief Executive of the Jockey Club, when I asked him this very question earlier in the year and I said, do more races necessarily mean more money? He said no. But let's hear from Charlie Parker. And the first question I put to him, given the complete sort of breakdown of communications between its own constituent parties, was that the Horsemen's Group was really not fit for purpose.
It certainly had its struggles. And I think the makeup of the group and the constitution is probably outdated, and our inability to negotiate properly and get this proposal done is probably highlighted highlighted those difficulties within it. We've got three of the five members were in favour, but we couldn't persuade the others. And then you've got the incredibly complicated way that then flows through to the BHA as well. So, in my view, it's a structural racing issue as much as anything else.
Well, Ralph Beckett clearly is in disagreement with the stance that you've taken. He says that you'd have settled for an even worse deal.
Well, I'm not sure what he's talking about. If he's talking about the compromises that Martin, Crotus and Ark have been asked to make to their original, to this proposal, those compromises result in less races and less prize money. So in that instance, we've ended up in a worse position for owners than we would have been if we had gone with the original proposal this time. If he's talking about the original deal that we were talking about 6, 7, 8 months ago, in my view, and this is an argument that probably can't ever come to fruition, but in my view, that would have made us more money as owners and stable staff and jockeys and trainers, because we would have been sharing in the gross media rights that ARC were producing, which would have made, I believe, would have made a bigger contribution to prize money. So in either case, I don't agree with him.
But what do you make of the central suggestion that this is short-term gain to the long-term detriment of the quality of the sport, and it ultimately it'll just turn everybody off?
Yeah, right. So the proposal that we were talking about was to increase the number of races through November through to middle of March. Those races are on the all-weather, and they would offer more opportunity for owners to run their horses, and the prize money on offer would have been significantly more than we race for today. It's an experiment. We would have seen what would have happened to betting revenues. We would have seen what happened to the levy. And we'd obviously seen what would happen to field sizes, bearing in mind that according to the BHA latest stats, there's more horses in training today than there were last year or the year before, etc., etc. So we would have seen whether the experiment worked. We would have been seen as innovating. The bookmaking fraternity obviously would have seen the impact on their P&Ls and cash flow, and we could have moved on. If it had worked, great. We could have built on it. If it hadn't worked, the first people to squeal and say, hang on, this isn't working, would have been obviously the bookmakers, the media rights companies and ARC themselves, whilst we would have been locked in, guaranteed to be running for that money for the rest of 2022. So I find it incredibly frustrating that we haven't been able to get that point across.
Yeah, apparently, Rafe says you could still get a deal by Thursday. Is that likely?
Yes, it's possible. I think it's possible. Yeah, it's possible. It's been a very, very long 3 or 4 weeks on this, and we thought we had a deal on Saturday night, and then we didn't. I'm loath to predict, Nick, but listen, the BHA are very, very, the door is very much open, and they are trying to persuade the guys to come through it. So that bit is sorted. If we can, as horsemen, get to a position we're comfortable, and then obviously ARC then have to be comfortable as well. But you never know.
Right, Charlie Parker there. Lydia, this is a short-term experiment. If it works, great. If it doesn't, fine. What's not to like?
Basically, we're in a situation where at the moment in British racing, more races does equal more money. But in the short term, that would appear to be great. Rafe has made the point that it probably isn't enough more money as well, that actually flows through to the sport, and there isn't enough transparency on the figures. And I would very much agree with him on that. The figures that are being bandied around by the likes of Martin Crudas, I think that they would need some explanation and some justification as to whether the extra money is purely what ARC would be earning from these extra races, or is there an element of holding the sport to ransom over this in order to try and get your way. I mean, what we need about this to make this decision is more transparency, more understanding of what actually is involved. But ultimately, it does come down to that argument. Do you want, you know, more money today at the potential, and I would say very likely expense of, in the medium to long term, turning punters off? It's just more races. How is that innovation? It's not a groundbreaking idea in the way that it is being sold. So,
well, isn't the innovation that it is a new way? It is a new mechanism by which to generate money for the sport. It's a non-traditional mechanism, having multi-race cards, nine and ten race cards. And Martin will insist that it's at nine. I mean, Martin Krulis's argument, I think, here would be, I know about making money for race courses, and I can pass some of that money on to horsemen, and this is the way that I'm going to do it. The National Trainers Federation don't really know anything about how to make money for race courses, so why are they now blocking a deal that would make money for their owners and a deal that their owners want? I mean, it's quite hard to swallow, isn't it? If you're an ROA member and your membership have voted for something and it's been blocked by the NTF when it pertains to your prize money, and the trainers are charging you umpteen thousand training bills a year, it's quite a bitter pill to swallow, that, I would have thought.
I think it depends on whether you have the long-term interests of the sport in mind. And, you know, Rafe has made the point repeatedly there, and it's a point that I've made, other people have made as well, that the sport's income, to an overwhelming degree and wholly during the course of the pandemic, is built on punters being engaged and wishing to bet on the sport of horse racing. And we know from analysis of field sizes and betting on smaller fields that is not as healthy a return as it is to have bigger, more competitive fields, you know, up to a point. We all know there's going to be smaller field sizes. The question is, do we accept that? And does that have a long-term detrimental effect on the sport? My answer to that would be yes.
Do you think there's an element of thin end of the wedge fear here, or sort of a mistrust of ARC, irrational fear, when we're talking about 140 new races out of the 10,000 races that are run in the entire calendar?
I don't think it's just ARC. It happens to be this, what Charlie Parker repeated call was an experiment, happens to be with ARC, but the idea that it would just stop with ARC, that nine race cards would end with that, that jockey club race courses, as Rafe mentioned, wouldn't be interested in also running nine race cards. I mean, this has huge long-term implications. I mean, the turf husbandry wouldn't be able to sustain that kind of idea. So you'd be pushing more and more races onto the all-weather. I mean, we already have more than a third of our flat races in Britain run on the all-weather. It is a fundamental shift in terms of what British racing means, done through the back door, done without any strategic long-term consideration of that.
But do we think that all members of the National Trainers Federation actually subscribe to this view? I think it's a pretty minority view, to be honest. It's one that where the sort of those who have pressed their view most significantly have won the day in terms of doing the deal. I'd say there's a lot of disgruntled trainers slightly lower down the trainers table here who are thinking, well, hang on a minute, I was looking for some nice prize money for my owners on the all weather over the winter. And do they not make the game go round just as much as the people at the top? Is there not a charge that this view could be seen as an elitist view?
I would argue that it is exactly the opposite. It's the most democratic view going out there, in that it is talking about whether horse racing remains relevant or not to its spectators, its audience, its punters. And, you know, if horse racing cannot continue to capture the imagination of its everyday fans, then it is going to start declining. And competitive, larger fields, over the years, the data proves that drives punter engagement much more than smaller, one-sided fields. But doesn't that
beg the question, why are they doing this? I mean, under the auspices of somebody like Martin Krulis, he was a high up in a massive global online betting operation. I'm presuming he's using smart data and betting analysts to work out how he's going to generate the most money. That's what he's there for. That's what he's in it for. They are a, you know, money making outfit.
I don't doubt that it will make, that will be a levy. I mean, as again Charlie Parker mentioned, the levy board accepted that over this short term period of this experiment, that there would be a net positive to the levy. And this is why, I mean, it's very easy to make this argument, the argument about more money, you know, more races, you know, jam today, don't worry about tomorrow. And it is far more difficult to land that longer term strategic argument. And my God, does this sport need a long term strategic argument?
On to other news today. Yesterday on this podcast, when we were discussing the Robbie Dunn, Bryony Frost story and the leak of the 120-page document from the VHA to the Sunday Times, I suggested that in the coming weeks there would be quite a bit spoken, possibly from within the PGA, about weighing room culture. I didn't expect it to come quite as soon as it did. David Bass is the incoming president of the Jumps Jockeys for the Professional Jockeys Association, and he's issued quite an interesting statement, Lydia, as he clearly seeks to step up to his role.
Yes, he has made the statement that there's lots of interesting things he said, some of which I have great sympathy with, some of which I'm slightly more sceptical about. So he said he doesn't think that this issue, which is the ongoing investigations into allegations of bullying and intimidation made by Bryony Frost against fellow rider Robbie Dunn. And clearly these investigations have been also leaked to the Sunday Times, which has resulted in the BHA referring itself to the Information Commissioner because they could not rule out that that leak had come from them. I'll come back to that. I should stress that Robbie Dunn, who denies all allegations, has the case would be brought under conduct prejudicial to the integrity or good reputation of horse racing. So the issue that David Bass is commenting on is, he says that I don't think it's an issue that needs to be blown out of proportion. Well, I very much agree with him, and I think it's very much in proportion from the sound of things, because one of the things that concerns me about this is that there has been an attempt by observers to suggest that what we're talking about is heat of the moment, adrenaline pumped post-race disagreements. And from everything that we know about the BHA and everything that I know about the sport and its processes suggests to me that it's very unlikely, and I would even state impossible, that a 120-page investigation will be based on that kind of thing, and that the catch-all charge, which is the biggest that the BHA has got, conduct prejudicial to the integrity or good reputation of British horse racing, is about a bit of post-race handbags. And also the length of time in which the investigation has gone on, that suggests that it's a far more complex arena than he said, she said, in the heat of the moment after a race. Now, clearly, the BHA have got huge questions to answer about the length of the investigation. I do agree with David Bass if he means that when he says this could have been dealt with in a much quicker and better way. If he means that the BHA should have progressed the complaint to proceedings sooner or not, then I very much agree. And this is an endemic problem with BHA investigations. However, if David Bass means that this should have kind of been sorted out quietly by a few senior jockeys in the weighing room, then I really could not disagree more. And there is a point where he says, it is sad that this has come out. And I really cannot agree with that. I think it can only be good for the long-term health of the weighing room and the culture within this sport that this has come out.
I like the idea of David Bass as the president of the PGA, though. He's an independent thinker. He's quite thoughtful. And I sort of welcome his appointment, really.
I totally agree. And he is a balanced and thoughtful man. And whilst it is clear that riders have a strong sense of camaraderie, there must be a really good support system in there at so many different times. The close-knitness of that environment, particularly to anyone who might be different, I think this is an opportunity for the weighing room to take a step back and think about what that looks like to someone who might be different to the majority. And, you know, David Bass said, you know, the weighing room was somewhere where you felt safe. And again, I mean, we're talking here as well about an environment, and this is not the jockey's fault. This is a structural thing, quite literally in many ways, about how racing has evolved. But you know, these days the demographic of the weighing room is very different. There are a lot more female riders, and yet in order to access the equipment that they need to do their job, they must go into the male change room. You know, take a step back. In normal society, that is not normal.
I mean, it is ridiculous that as a woman, you have to walk into a male changing room for anything, really. I mean, there should be facilities provided that's not an obligation or a necessity. I can't really understand that at all. And race courses have got to get on this. I know the PJA, and I know I've spoken about this to John Holmes, the chairman, and Paul Struthers, the CEO. They have been badgering the race courses to do something about this.
Well, I know that something is underway. I mean, I know I'm a trustee of the British Racing School, and the British Racing School and the National Horse Racing College have also contacted the BHA and racecourses to express their concern about this state of affairs, because obviously, clearly they also have a safeguarding responsibility for the young people who are still under their oversight, who might go to the racecourses. So they wanted the racecourses and the BHA to address this, and I know that talks are quite far progressed and ideas are well underway. Clearly, it's going to cost money. I think the sport has to accept that, but also I think what needs to be achieved within that weighing room space is managing to bring it into the 21st century in terms of, you know, the equipment and the facilities that are provided to jockeys, male and female. But what you wouldn't want to lose is for it to become so sanitized that ability to gather and feel that camaraderie that so many of the weighing rooms speak so eloquently about, and that David Bass has mentioned in his piece. You wouldn't want to sacrifice that completely in the pursuit of very correct, very understandable and admirable desire to make sure that racecourse facilities are fully up to date. So it's going to be quite a challenge, and it needs to be pursued thoughtfully, but it is incredibly urgent.
Lydia, just back to the BHA and the fact that they've reported themselves to the Information Commission. If they get slapped with a big fine, I mean, how bad could that be?
I think it could be really bad. I mean, let's just start at the beginning. It is bad that the BHA cannot categorically rule out that someone within its division of it has not leaked this to the Sunday Times. And I find it extraordinary that anybody who has who is right-minded would risk the fair hearing of a case as important as that. That's one. But two, yeah, they're risking a whacking great fine. And three, it means that there will at least be some transparency, in that all the questions about the BHA's role in this that participants and the rest of the sport might have, they should be answered. So, you know, it's referred itself to the Information Commission, which is embarrassing.
Now, in 2019, the former rider and trainer Harriet Bethel was left fighting for her life after suffering some very serious head injuries in a fall. And yesterday, she completed an entire circuit of Pontefract Racecourse. Those of you who don't know, Pontefract is the longest circuit in the UK and has an extremely stiff uphill finish, raising money for the Injured Jockeys Fund. And we're hoping to help Harriet get to her original target of £50,000. She has got way over halfway there already, and she joins me now. Harriet, how are you feeling this morning, and congratulations?
My legs are like lead. Oh, thank you very much.
Well, it's great to hear you. It was great to see you yesterday as well. Such an extraordinary story of personal endeavour. For those who aren't familiar, just take us back to what you had to go through.
I can't exactly remember everything that I had to go through, because I know I had to go through a lot before I even knew about it, if you get me. I had to have a tendon lengthening operation on my left foot, so that the heel hit the floor first, because I'd been laid down for so long. it had shrunk, so it needed to be lengthened. And then, like, I had a craniotomy, or cranioplasty, as they call it. So they put like a titanium plate in the front of my head. Whilst I was in the Wellington Hospital, I spent all of that 6 months learning how to walk again. I don't think I could even stand up until probably like just a little bit before. So that was like a massive achievement.
The Injured Jockeys Fund were by your side from day one, which is why you wanted to raise money for them. We talk about the IJF a lot. I wanted to know from you just exactly the way in which they have helped you and continue to do so.
Well, yeah, so they were there at my bedside, and in fact, even whilst I was in the coma, I had like a sort of a dream, or a far out dream anyway. I had lots of those, but I had a dream that I was on a boat in the middle of the Mediterranean with the IJF. And it was near Spain, so not that I knew where it was, because I was flat on my back. And then they sorted, when I left hospital, they sorted out all the kind of carers and physios and OTs and neuropsychologists. And they've just been absolutely astronomical at sorting things out.
Your recovery has astounded everybody who has treated you, everybody who knows you. You obviously credit the IJF with a lot of that, but clearly much of that has to do with your own personal journey and your determination. How do you feel within yourself now, Harriet?
Yeah, I feel okay. I feel very proud about yesterday, but then, like, in my opinion, like, enough is never enough, and like, I pretty much expect them more from me all the time. So it's just one of those things. It's like, you're just never satisfied.
And when you're pushing yourself that hard, and for obvious reasons, and you know, you're, as you say, you're never satisfied, is it quite important to have people alongside you going, yes, keep pushing, but at the same time, manage your expectations, be careful? Or do you just have people spurring you on the whole time? What's the right balance?
So my counsellor, Lisa Harris, she would say that you need to sort of be a bit more measured about things and sort of not push all the time. Just like, I don't know, pace yourself and realise what you can, can't do. And
what you did do yesterday was walk Ponty, and the smile on your face when you finished, it was just a delight to behold. A lovely interview with Chris Dixon on Racing TV afterwards. And now, as I say, I really want to help you get to 50,000 for the Injured Jockeys Fund. This is still realistic, isn't it, Harriet?
Yeah, I'd like to think so. But hey, come on, let's do it.
We're going to try and help you do it for sure. Okay, give us the details. How do we get stuck in?
So you can either send a cheque to me or Mum up in Yorkshire, or easier still is go to the Just Giving page, Harriet-Bethel.
Okay, Just Giving, Harriet-Bethel, Bethell, wherever you are in the world. What Harriet did yesterday is nothing short of extraordinary, and you've heard the reasons why. The Injured Jockeys Fund have been with her every step of the way and have done an amazing job. Harriet, you've done an amazing job. Thank you so much for talking to me, and I wish you all the best with your continuing recovery.
Oh no, thank you very much, Nick.
Well, it's Tuesday, and that means it's time for our weekly Bloodstock segment, brought to you with our friends at Weatherby's. Now, one of the industry bodies with whom Weatherby's works most closely is the Thoroughbred Breeders Association here in the UK, and today's guest is the eminent vet James Crowhurst, who, as well as being a senior consultant clinician at Newmarket Equine Hospital, also sits on the TBA's board of trustees, for whom he's also their long-term veterinary advisor. Now, the TBA yesterday published equine welfare guidelines for the breeding sector. These guidelines aim to complement the basic principles of horse care detailed within the UK government's codes of practice for the welfare of horses. It reflects the TBA's ongoing commitment to protect and promote the health and welfare of the British thoroughbred and to support breeders with the provision of educational materials to guide them and their employees on best practice. And James is with me now. James, why has this come about and why now?
Well, morning, Nick. Thank you. We've been following the Horse Welfare Board's progress and have contributed to that and their premise of a life well lived. And as you well know, the horse in training is quite a short part of a whole horse's life. And we were encouraged to produce some guidelines for the horse before and after its time in training. These are not an exhaustive list of how to do things. It's more aimed at perhaps new people into the breeding industry, and they are there to add flesh to the laws that exist in this country, the DEFRA Code of Practice for Horses, which is quite sensible but has not much detail. So TBA felt that we might be able to contribute to having a set of guidelines on welfare to help raise the already sort of very high standards that are on just about every stud in Britain, and by raising standards and understanding for people and horses, then hopefully you lower any risks of anything going wrong. So we have had a committee that's been refining these over quite a period of time, and then we've run it past several people on studs in management to see what they think, and it's come down to a document that we are very pleased with, and I hope will help people to understand what we are expecting of people that own and look after horses before and after their training career.
Where do you think the key areas of potential improvement are in terms of horse husbandry and the breeding industry?
Well, it's a good point. I think that as a vet, more and more we're learning to understand horses' behaviour and interactions with others. So I think as we learn more about that, we can contribute to their experience of their life at stud, during training and afterwards. So I think this sort of behaviour and environment the horses are in is particularly important. How to keep them with company, how to understand their relationships with others. They all have a pecking order when you turn them out in paddocks. So there's always one that's the boss and one that's last, and all the others know their place. So I think as we understand a little bit more about that, we can improve how to manage them in a way that they really like. And, you know, a lot of people put a lot of effort into doing that so that they're comfortable and, you know, minimize changes to them. And as you all know, they like a routine. Horses really like a routine. And if you can keep that up, then they're usually pretty happy.
Now, anybody who wants to have a deeper dive into this and perhaps is developing a small breeding operation, there are five videos, aren't there, that you've released today?
Yep. We've done these videos. They're quite short, and I think they're very good. They're the things that we think to start with people would like to see and hear about. So one is on moving horses, transporting horses. Another one about the health. I've helped contributed to one on condition scoring of adult horses. We haven't put the youngsters in that yet. And We've also included the older horse and how to look after them out at grass. So I hope people will find these useful. They're done in a very good way, I think, and we're pleased with them.
James Crowhurst there. Thanks to James, to Harriet Bethel, of course, and please do help as we try and get her to 50,000 for the Injured Jockeys Fund, and to Charlie Parker and Rafe Beckett earlier in the programme. Lydia is still with me. Lydia, you have a tip for me.
I do. It's in Yarmouth's 4:15, and the horses, Wow William, showed a slightly improved form for first-time cheek pieces last time, and I think can go on better today.
Lydia, thanks so much. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again tomorrow. Bye-bye. You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you in association with FitzDares, the Racehorse Owners Association, and Thoroughbred Racing Commentary.